With your permission, we'd like to talk shop for just a moment.
Because we've got a good racket going, you're not going to be able to touch our own.
Oh, okay, so you've got a racket going.
Cookies are not the only food. I tell that to my children all the time.
It's time for the Publisher Fight. It's time for the Publisher Fight.
Here's a man that really appreciates that new England pound.
Hi, how's it going, and welcome to the Video Week podcast. This week's guest is Alison Keith. Ali is the founder and principal at the Excellence Office. I got to know Ali when she was working at Kraft Heinz, where she headed up media, and she's worked across various brands and in the agency world, and is now bringing her skills to bear on her new consultancy, the Excellence Office. She's somebody I learn from in every conversation with her, and I think you'll find the same during this episode. Things we discuss are why brands spend so much on social video. We get into the reasons behind the short-termism at advertisers and agencies. Why brands don't invest quite enough, in my opinion, in having people with real media expertise in-house. I'm not belittling the wonderful heads of media we have, but at many companies, either that role doesn't exist or you have people who are seriously under-resourced. We also get into the brand-agency relationship, Ali's view on the impact of programmatic advertising on the ecosystem, and we get into AI and in-housing. A few bits coming up from us. We've got Cannes on the horizon, of course. We're going to be running an event there called Video Week Live. We've got some fantastic speakers and partners, so if you search for Video Week Live, you'll be able to see what's going on and be able to sign up to register your interest. We do have limited capacity, but please do put your name down if you think you should be there, and hopefully we'll be able to accommodate you. Please don't be offended if we can't. It's been a very popular event. Also, we've got the TV Rise Forum Town Hall happening later that afternoon on Tuesday 23rd. That's going to be more of a town hall session for senior leaders who are a member of TV Rise Forum. This is Video Week's new community, very much aimed at bringing leaders together from buy side and sell side in a neutral setting to work out how to make the supply chain a bit more efficient, a bit more effective, without adhering to any one type of technology or acting in the interests of any one group. It's very much about making all boats rise. Okay, so now I will pass over to my conversation with Ali, and I hope you enjoy. So, Ali, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. It's lovely to be here.
Right, you recently left Kraft Heinz to set up your own venture. It'd be great to just get a bit of a sense of your past career, how you got into the industry in the first place, and how you came up to where you are today.
It's definitely very non-linear, that is for sure. I started off brand side in kind of fashion and then leisure retail, so bars and restaurants. And then I always thought that my creative agencies looked like they were having a lot more fun than I was, and they got to work on loads of brands, and I just worked on one. So I decided to take the leap and joined a small creative and brand agency. It was at the sort of very early part of digital and social media. I'd always taught myself how to buy paid search ads back in the day because I couldn't afford an agency to do it with my budgets. So I'd always been quite practical and hands-on. And then in the creative agency, as Facebook kind of kicked off and you started having people have Facebook games and custom brand pages back when those were a thing, and our clients started asking us to build these things, and nobody really knew how, or it was just sort of up and coming. So I dived in and took over that area of the agency to a degree, working with the developers on how to build that. But one of my big things from the creative side of the business was always, as most creative agencies did back then, would sit there going, oh, the media agency keeps misusing my creative. I don't like what they're doing with it. And then there was an opportunity for me to, in my head, go and fix that. So I joined Isobar Global back when it was still both creative and media together, and really enjoyed that kind of intersection of digital and then, learning about the offline side of the business and the impact it can have on consumers, and sort of fell in love with the idea of media as both an industry and the creative ways that it can be used so much more than just potentially the boxes that it had been put at in the past. And so that was kind of, I guess, the hook of my career was to how do you bring creativity and media together? And that's always been something that I think I've stepped towards, and I like working across multiple things. Part of the reason I enjoyed working in agencies and in the companies that I had was that there was dozens of brands, dozens of ways you could bring creativity and media to life, which I have always thoroughly enjoyed. And the reason I enjoy it is because you can put consumers at the heart of it. And I think there's a lot more to come from the various different types of media in the industry in order to bring brands to life. And I enjoy working with companies who play in that space.
It's quite interesting, actually, what you're saying. But yeah, I think there's a lot of people who obviously there's lots of people who were old school media, what you might call old school traditional media, and then they have experienced a digital transition. But equally, I think it's all your story is probably almost a more common one in the more over the last 15, 20 years, where people are starting in digital and then they're actually learning the appreciate sort of. Gaining an appreciation for non-digital media and the impact that it can have. I think that that's a kind of a story that we're sort of seeing more and more. I know a lot of people who, when they first come over from digital or digital video to TV, and they only just then start to learn just how powerful TV is. And
And
it's
I
kind
think
of
we're
a.
still learning. I attended a conference recently more on the technology side of TV than the media side of TV. And I think it's fascinating. And in 20 years of working in what I do, I hadn't really appreciated the technology that goes behind what appears on your TV screen, whether that's CTV and or linear TV, and how that's changing and evolving. So, we call it legacy media, whatever you want to call it. Frankly, Facebook is like 20 years old now. That is legacy media. So as everything continues to evolve, the technology that's coming behind a lot of linear and CTV is so powerful, and it's really incredible that when people are like, oh, TV is dead or it doesn't ever change, A, not changing is not necessarily a negative. And B, I would argue that's wrong because the technology behind it is evolving all the time and getting smarter, as well as continuing with the quality levels that we come to associate with it.
But yeah, good to get background on what you're doing now. What kind of consultancy stuff are you working on? And
It varies. I think, and this is probably not my finest branding moment to say that when people say, what is it you do? And it's like, well, tell me what your problem is first. So the perception that I've always had in my last couple of roles have been based around excellence and how do you bring that to life? And that can be through effectiveness, it can be through process, it can be through having the right technology, and any of the above. And I'm always a believer that there's no one way to do anything. So I like to take people's challenges, whether that's a brand or a technology, unpick what's really, and this is again something that media or media craft and media planning really taught me to do, was unpick the jobs to be done. Like what really needs to be changed or what do people need to do differently? And then what are the tools that we have at our disposal in order to do that with excellence? Not best in class, that's just slightly better than everybody else, but actually with excellence and using that as a strive point on a daily basis. Not a transformation, not something that happens once, but it's a mindset piece. So working with different groups of people who are interested in How do you level up continuously, I guess?
Yeah, I think yeah, I know. Well, we probably can't go into the ins and outs, but I know that some of the work you've been doing, and you've a few anecdotes, and I think there's plenty of people out there who need help or don't necessarily have a huge amount of self-awareness or where they sit in the market. I think having that outside lens is absolutely invaluable, or how to speak to customers, or those kind of problems. We see it all the time. More intimate events where, yeah, you realize people see that where they sit in the market mirrored back to them by their customers sometimes when they're having deeper off the record conversations. And yeah, I think that there's a, everyone has misconceptions about how they're perceived or their value.
Being able to put on different hats as well. And I think the variety I've had in my career, I kind of value its non-linearness, and sitting across various different roles and different companies, because actually it enables me to think at a problem from multiple different angles. So as you say, like if you're a tech company, can you talk about yourselves in a way that brand marketers are going to understand? Can you talk about yourselves in a way that a CFO or a procurement person is going to understand? Like, how do you come at problems with different mindsets in order to make sure that it's a really robust solution?
So I'm curious. I mean, it's not so long since you were in a head of media role, and I know that you move in WFA circles, and I'm curious about why social networks or what I call algorithmic video. Why do you think it's capturing just so much spend? When we see these industry growth rates, it seems like video, CTV is certainly still growing as well. Streaming is growing, but a huge amount of that growth is being captured by a handful of companies still. I'm just curious why that is in your view.
I mean, there's a lot of methodologies around where media spend should be deployed. It can, these things come in and out of fashion. So, do you look at how much time consumers are spending with a certain type of media? That's always been oh, people are watching less TV, they're spending more time scrolling on their phone, was for a long time was a justification of media choices. I think it's also accessibility. For if you're a brand that doesn't necessarily have large media teams and massive agency teams at your disposal, the self-serve option of a lot of social video is very empowering for brands who can't afford large agency teams. I think the very early ability to look at measurement and invention of new metrics, engagement was considered far more important than reach for a period by large areas of the industry. And, I know I've gone through times when I've been like, yes, for this, I really want lots of engagement. I think when you look at research and you look at studies, reach fundamentally is the underpinning of brand building. When a platform has a billion users, arguably that can be considered a proxy for reach. And I'm not saying that it can't build reach, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it is the same type of reach, if that makes sense. So the way that you can work with reach in, let's say, linear TV versus social video, fundamentally, to me, they're doing slightly different tasks, and therefore optimizing towards different outcomes. You don't, it's not that you can't do TV in order to drive immediate sales. You can. It's not just for long-term brand building. And in the same way, you can use social video to drive short-term sales, but you can also do it to drive longer-term engagement. But it's understanding the jobs to be done. And I think that is something that you need to go back and look at the marketing science behind it, and really understanding where your brand sits. As you say, what are you solving for? And therefore, what are the right mechanics to do it? And brands don't want to be left behind. When you see changes in consumer behavior, you want to make sure you're doing the right things to be in the right places in order to engage with them. However, I think budget drift and budget constraints have meant that, you know, for me, it shouldn't be either or, it should be both. However, no CFO turns around and goes, oh, the media landscape's changed. Obviously, you're going to need a lot more money in order to cope with that. That's not the reality of what P&Ls can support, and choices have to be made. But for me, there is a role for all types of video. You just have to be clear on what that is and exactly what you expect to get out of it.
Yeah, I was in Hamburg this week for an RTL event, and ad managers, both the sort of RTL Alliance's own ad manager, which was very impressive. You can sort of buy TV across Europe from their ad manager. They also had DPG speaking as well, where they've built a really sophisticated one. I think they picked up an award somewhere this week for it, and do you think there's room for, like, do you think that, other types of media have just been missing a trick by not having that self-serve functionality there for, particularly smaller to mid-sized brands? Or do you think it's even some of the larger brands too are keen to have that self-serve functionality?
There's self-serve by the brand, there's self-serve by the agency. But I think I love what RTL Ad Alliance has been doing. It's something that I've been wanting because I've always worked in global or regional roles. And I would want to be able to not necessarily plan TV across markets, I'm not saying that, but to be able to have those business partnerships that are multi-market does make it more manageable when you've got, you know, frankly, limited time and teams, lots and lots of brands you need to work with. So I do think there is an area of that what the major platforms did was they democratized areas of advertising very early. So if you think, as I said, Google search ads, I worked for a bar company. We had 50 bars. I wanted to do paid search ads. I couldn't afford an agency, so I just learned to do it myself. And Google, to be fair, did a really good job of making it simple and easy to get involved. Now, by its very nature, the way that TV has kind of evolved and pricing, et cetera, because it's not biddable, was not designed like that. However, I think now with I'm not saying we need to get into a whole biddable self-serve, I can go online and buy Channel 4 tomorrow. But having that connectivity across similar brands, and by brands, I mean media brands like RTL in multiple countries, and being able to have those conversations at a not just a local market single channel level is super interesting. And I think it democratizes what has been, you know, very large, we'll call it legacy media of TV that most brands, whether they're small brands in a big company or medium-sized brands as a standalone, would love to do TV because it's great, it's quality, and it works. However, it means you pretty much have to have an agency, which means you have to have the money to spend on the fees. And are you going to be able to buy enough of it to make a difference? So I do think that these types of technologies that are starting to emerge now really does start to bring the democratization that social network advertising brought to small, you know, very small brands like pizza places and hairdressers and anyone in between. Imagine being able to do that in your local area, that you could have some TV ads for your local restaurant, for example. I think that would be a really, really fascinating development in the industry.
Advertisers and agencies, I mean, both tend to be accused of short-termism. And I'm curious, for your experience of, being at major brands and agencies, do you think that's fair? And what's driving that short-termism, if it is fair?
The data tells us it's fair, right? You know, Les and Peter have been telling us that for years. There's multiple books about it. You know, Byron Sharp talks about it. It is that balance of the long and short of it. And when you're in a business, if you said to somebody, we can do some really long-term things, but there's a short-term risk that we're going to have massive problems. It's very difficult to just stay. Well, no, I don't want any. No one sits there and says, I don't want any short-term outcomes. However, again, I don't believe it's either or. You have to build the long and short-term memory structures, and there's different ways that you can do it. Quarterly reporting cycles, performance marketing is much easier to measure than long-term sentiment and what might happen in a year or so's time if you do everything right. So it's understandable and kind of human nature, I think, to default to things that you can measure and things that make a difference to your life now. However, it does have a massive impact on growth. We can see that. And there's, have we optimized ourselves slightly into a corner is a question that pops into my head. Just because we can optimize everything, does that mean that we lose the creativity and the muscle memory of how to build long-term memory structures with consumers? I'm sure everyone has a brand that they follow on social media or they love the ads, but they don't actually buy. I'll give you my favorite example, Tetley Tea in the UK. I love the ads, with the little characters that they had, and they brought them back, and it's brilliant. Have I ever bought Tetley Tea? No. So again, it's built a long-term memory structure, but it hasn't made any kind of short-term impact on me. So I think it is that definition again, and I'll go back to it because it's my favorite thing. You need to know your job's to be done. There are going to be times when being short-termist is exactly the right thing to do, but you always have to be mindful of the sacrifices you're making for the long term when you focus too much on short term. And equally being mindful of what it can say about you. If let's use an example of, I'll use DFS as an example in the UK, sofa company, known for being heavily discounted for long periods of time. I would love to understand how many people have ever bought a DFS sofa at full price when you can just wait 3 months and they're going to have a sale. So it's like what you're saying about your company when you act in a very, very short-termist way can again not build the right long-term memory structures of brand perception and that you might want.
I would argue that Tetley Tea have a product problem.
Didn't like to
It
say it's not my favorite type of tea, I have to say.
took me years to discover Yorkshire tea, which is far,
I
far
know, same
closer
here.
to Irish tea. And I was always like, oh, the tea is really bad. And then Yorkshire tea was sitting there all along. And it's great. So I'm obviously saying this to you as somebody who, understands media, but I've met so many brand marketers over the years who often I say take no interest in it at all. I think they often just have other fish to fry, and that's just have other things to do. But you often, I feel slightly concerned that maybe they're completely beholden to what their agencies or the platforms are telling them. Why do you think? I mean, for me, a head of media, which many companies don't have, but I think I think it's one of the best investments that any brand can make, I think, in terms of just understanding where bodies are buried, what's actually going to have impact. But why do you think, so many advertisers don't take a greater interest or invest in people who truly understand the landscape?
The complexity of the landscape has meant that we now need so much more understanding. When it was TV and print, it was fairly easy, to understand. And they weren't things that you could really go and dive in and do yourself as a marketer. You needed an agency to make the creative and then help you negotiate the prices for it to be seen. I think as it's got more complicated, A, that can make some people uncomfortable. And B, if you've never experienced all of the facets, it's difficult to understand the value of that level of learning. I mean, there's always been, are you a T-shaped learner? And I remember having this conversation in my career with one of my bosses who was like, do you want to be a specialist or do you want to be a generalist? And I don't necessarily believe in T-shaped or even M-shaped. I always like to feel like my skill set is kind of more like a comb. So it's, deep at the top, but I can go deep on lots and lots of subjects. And to be able to have a full understanding of media, and whether that's discussing regional TV strategies in Germany versus the out-of-home landscape in Brazil, it's a lot to cope with and take in, especially if you're in a global role and you have to cover dozens and dozens of countries. So I think it can feel overwhelming in its complexity if you look at it as a purely technical exercise. When you look at it from what I call, I haven't used the phrase consumer journey for years. I always think of it as consumer mapping, understanding what territories we want to own, what's important, what bits are actually going to make a difference. When you come at it from that perspective, it's much easier to be curious about it versus just going, do you understand what an impression is versus a GRP? You know, all too often, I think media can come off as a maths exercise versus a human exercise. And fundamentally, to me, media is one of the most human things. And every part of marketing is technically, or in my view, a type of media. Your pricing is a way that you talk to your consumer. Your packaging is a way that you talk to your consumer. These are all types of media that you have paid for in some way, whether that's through R&D or directly with, you know, TV advertising. All of it, you're trying to build this brand persona in this way that you go to market. And I think when you position media like that, it's very easy to be passionate about it. And when you say, you know, people rely on their agencies, having been on both those agency side and brand side, when I was in an agency, I wanted my clients to trust me. And when I was in the client side, I wanted to trust my agency, because at the end of the day, it's a relationship and it shouldn't be transactional in the sense of, well, you just do everything and you just tell me when it's done. Or like, I don't trust the agency. I think they're trying to do things I don't want them to do. Like, both of those are highly negative ways of operating. When you come at it and you get a great partnership between brand organization and agency, it becomes incredibly seamless, and then it's very easy to spend time on the craft of media instead of the you know, the base level capability. But do I wish that more people had the opportunity to have that kind of training? Yes, I love delivering that kind of getting people who've never done me. I'm doing some for somebody soon, and it's brands that are only just stepping into the media space, and, you know, the P&L can support doing it. So it's like, how do we do it really well from the get-go, and how do we be excited about it and be inspired by media? You know, we were talking before we started about how lucky we are to work in this industry, and we are. The things we get to do and talk about and spend time on are, for me, incredibly, incredibly exciting. And, you know, if you think about it from a lot of other framing within an industry, like, it is one of your largest spends normally as a business. It is important. It gets more and more scrutiny as to how effective it is, not just efficient. So if you spend like 40% of your revenue on a factory, well, you'd want to know how it worked, right? Or you made a big CapEx investment into something, you'd be like, I want to understand the detail behind how it works, not just the results, but like, how is it going to get there? And we're spending so much of our marketing budget on media. And to a lot of people, it is sort of still like magic. And I'm not saying that we therefore need to consistently measure it to death, because it can lead to interesting choices. But as you say, having that kind of media literacy and a curiosity about, you know, what happens if I do this? What happens to this new thing? We talk about AI as though it is, I mean, I was talking to somebody earlier, and, you know, some of the stuff, it does still sound like science fiction or magic. But actually, when you look at the intricacies of how media comes together in the human psychology, in the way that we talk to people about brands, it's so fascinating. I think occasionally that, though, the quality of the training just needs a massive upgrade, and the way that you frame it so that it feels relevant, whether that's talking to your CFO about it, marketing, you know, insight team, supply chain. Like, I've had fascinating conversations about media with supply chain and how you can use supply chain forecasting data in order to inform media spend size and choices. Like, that's a whole business conversation. It's not just, oh yeah, we hired a couple of media people and we've shoved them in a corner. Like, really putting that understanding about how media interacts with your consumers at the heart of a business, for me, is a very exciting potential.
I'm curious about how, just how much power do advertisers have in the market? And I say that as somebody who, I think I've said in the past, I would really love to see the advertisers, making more noise about, whatever it is in the market, whether it's, ad fraud or just, a lack of ethics, particularly at, some large platforms. And but I'm curious just how much power do brands have, particularly when it comes to large platforms. I know I was speaking to somebody from a very major media buying agency, and they were saying, well, they don't listen to us. And I was actually quite shocked because I was thinking, if they're not listening to you with all your aggregated spend from so many major brands, like, who are they listening to? And I'm curious, do you think large brands still have a lot of power in the market, particularly when it comes to big tech and, companies like Meta, for example?
The root of this goes back to what I was saying about the self-service element of it. So if you think, we kind of go, oh yes, the top 10 beauty brands or whatever, like, but there's thousands of beauty brands. There aren't just the top 10. The top 10 are probably the ones that you can think of off the top of your head. If every single one of those had the same media budget, would they all still make the same media choices? I don't know. So I think, there's been numbers released in the past, not recent, of what percentage of Meta's spend is derived from small to medium-sized enterprises. If that is as big as that number is, then big brands aren't that meaningful a contribution to their bottom line. So does it mean we shouldn't still have conversations? No, we should, and we should care about where our consumers are spending time and the experiences that they have with our advertising. But it doesn't mean that just because you're a big brand that you have the power and or to impose it on what small to medium-sized enterprises and or any other enterprise is doing. So I think there is groups, like you say, like the WFA, where people can discuss these things and the platforms do consistently come to the table at places like the WFA and others, and directly with large brands to listen. Does it mean that they instantly make sea changes like it might feel that in the past they were used to when Mark Pritchard would say something? Maybe that has changed over the time, but then they have massively, massively grown their business in a direction that isn't actually focused around large brands. Is there an element of us sitting there going, well, why aren't people listening to us? We're so big. But in the grand scheme of things, and the number of brands that sit in every single vertical is much larger than the sum total of let's say the top 10 brands in most scenarios. If you're talking about insurance and stuff, that tends to be very, very top heavy. But when you start getting into the CPG world, there isn't just one type of condiment brand. There's thousands, and they're growing all the time. And I think the platforms have given a lot of accessibility for small brands to use their platforms to become big, or bigger. And therefore, there is that. I don't even want to call it a power shift because that sounds dreadfully dramatic. But it does mean that the emphasis as a business for the platforms isn't about topping out more growth out of big brands. It's about growing smaller ones, and that fundamentally makes a difference on who they listen to.
Yeah, and do you think there's been a shift where maybe there was a time where platforms would have a ton of people dedicated to particular agency or particular brand? Do you think that's changed over time, where they don't have, 15 account managers working on one brand, or is that
That's
still a thing?
definitely changed.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know whether it's still a thing for everyone everywhere, But I think there's definitely been a shift from heavy teams. You know, we've seen the news this week at Meta of the layoffs there. And when you kind of read about it, not necessarily in this one, but in previous ones, it does tend to be around those kind of client service areas. So does that signal a shift in how they think they're going to manage brands? Maybe. I don't know. I'm not inside their business, but yeah, I've definitely seen a change in the volume of support people that are engaging.
I appreciate this is a bit of a broad question, but the brands you're speaking to, I'm curious about how they're feeling about their agency relationships right now, and particularly with AI, it's no longer waiting in the wings. But with is AI making more brands think, oh great, we can take this in-house now, or is it adding a new layer of complexity where they become more dependent on their agency? Agencies for expertise than before, or have they, are they maybe, thinking a bit more deeply about in-housing where, historically, it often hasn't worked out quite so well, and they go back cap in hand to their agencies.
Well, having been one of those people who've in-housed and then out-housed, as I called it at the time, and gone back to an agency, in-housing isn't easy, and I'm not necessarily convinced that the advent of AI is this sudden magic trigger that people think it is, that, oh, I'll just don't need an agency anymore. I love being in agencies, I love working with agencies. The quality of some of the people in them is second to none. The tools that they can have at their disposal are things that are very, very difficult to replicate in-house. You know, when you look at something like CCS Planner out of Dentsu, there's absolutely no way a large organization could stitch that type of thing together for themselves. So I do think it is, how do you get the best out of those partnerships, whether you're using AI or not, is kind of regardless. I think the secret is in how do you, I guess I'd flip the question around. We all spend a load of time saying like how are the holdcos going to fix themselves, or like agencies need to change. I would argue that there's also large elements of clients need to change. If it's a relationship and it's a genuinely two-way conversation, a large chunk of that is how do you look at yourself and what needs to change about you and the ways that you work in order to get the best out of your agency. I've delivered a training for years called How to Be a Great Client because I've been in an agency and I've been a client. No one teaches people how to be clients. We spend a lot of time in agencies teaching people how to service clients and, be good at media, etc. And this goes back to our earlier comments around media capabilities. One of the simplest trainings that I've ever delivered is like how to write a great brief. Who teaches people how to write a brief? Very few companies do. So there's tools and techniques that you can have, and it doesn't mean you just get the AI to write the brief because everyone can tell that it has. Doesn't mean you can't use it to help you, but it's finding that two-way relationship and transparency. And I think coming from an agency background, it helps that I know how agencies work. Most of the time when I've hired people into my in-house or brand side media teams, I've tried to find people who have a background of agency life because you need to appreciate the pressures of it. And I think for me saying, oh, AI is going to just reduce the amount of people we need in agency teams is a bit of a reductive thing and quite threatening and doesn't speak to the power of media. As organizations at all. Does it mean we can get rid of some of the menial tasks so that people can focus on being strategic? Like, that's what we should be striving for. Like, freeing up people's time to focus on the jobs to be done and the problems to be solved is far more important than necessarily using AI just to cut people out of the equation.
Completely agree with you, and I think agencies are often unfairly maligned. Some of the hardest working people and smartest people in the industry
And I say that as someone who was quite a difficult client as well. Like, I'm not easy because I do understand it and I take it very seriously and I'm very passionate about it. So it's not like I was sitting there being the over-friendly client who lets agencies get away with everything. But every time I would push them, it was because I wanted us both to be better. And I believed in bringing my agency along for the journey with me and the team, you know, investing in them, investing in helping them get that promotion and helping them, you know, float ideas about things that they might want to do on specific brands and being that genuine sounding board for your agency team. And when you get that partnership right, like the dividends are big. Like you see the impact in the work very, very quickly when you work well with your agency team and you invest time and energy in being a good client.
You said something to me once about people maybe being a bit too obsessed with cheap as well. Could you expand a bit on that in terms of because I'm convinced that so many of the industry problems can be linked back to procurement, looking for the cheapest price, getting agencies to, have their, parade their wares and spend months on these pitches, and then they pick the cheapest. It's something I've heard of. I don't know whether that's a standard experience, but it's something I've certainly heard of. And I think once you're in that place, you're incentivizing the agency to make up money in other ways that aren't don't necessarily align. But often sometimes I've heard from clients as well where there's a bit of a nod and a wink. They get the procurement person gets their bonus because they've gotten a great deal. It's a bit of a nod and a wink of, I know that you're gonna have to make up the money somehow. Good luck to you, but just don't tell me about it. But I'm curious about your view on that. Or, is it more of a cheap media that you were thinking of when you said that?
First off, I'm going to defend my procurement colleagues to the death because some of them have been the most passionate media advocates in their businesses. And I would argue that I've probably asked for far more difficult stuff than a lot of my procurement colleagues ever did. I think they are great stewards of the process. Yes, they're there to, well, not just they're there. No one wants to overpay, but equally, I remember doing a series of pitches, and my opening, not in the meeting, but like for the Q&A session as the brief was issued, was like, "We are a difficult and complicated client. Please don't bring me some tiny lean team because you think that's what I want to see because it won't cost me very much, when longer term, it will cost us having a decent relationship because you will have underestimated how complicated we are. So I'd rather you come in with something that you feel quite uncomfortably large, and then we talk about it, versus coming in with what you think is just going to flip the switch and win it instantly because it's tiny and it's cheap." I realize this is an unusual attitude, and I've been told many times that I'm a very unusual client, but I do believe that you get the agency you deserve, right? If you go in with the attitude that I am doing an RFP because I want to save money, you will. But you probably won't solve the problem of why you were doing the pitch in the first place. Understanding why you were doing an RFP in the first place is one of the most important steps. And I have a very rigorous process around how I RFP that's respectful of both sides because I don't want to waste agencies' time. Like thousands of hours, as you say, in a process that's painful, uncomfortable, and at the end of the day, they're not clear at the end of it why whoever won. I believe in transparency about how it's being judged. I believe in transparency about who's going to be on the buying committee. I believe in transparency about expectations and exactly what you are like as a client. And when I've loved it the most is when agencies have come back and occasionally been like, "No, this is horrible," or "I do not appreciate it that you have asked us to do X." Like, I never wanted to be in some ivory tower saying that, you know, we know better because we're a big brand company. We were looking for partners, and I realized that that is slightly unusual. But I will also say that I also never asked for cheap media, right? I don't want to overpay, but I want it to be productive, efficiency. And I come at this as someone who massively bought into programmatic and efficiency and et cetera when it came out, and reducing price and getting more for less. And but it, realizing with time, and again, this is continuous education of myself, of long-term brand building versus short-term outcomes, and working with some brands that, you know, genuinely do that very, very well, taught me that some things aren't cheap, right? If you buy a BMW and someone said, I will sell you a BMW 7 Series for 10 grand, brand new, you'd be like, what's wrong with it? Because that's too good to be true. I believe the same is true of media. It can be effective and it doesn't have to cost the earth. But equally, if I want to reach some very specific people, or I have a really, really specific creative execution I want to do, and I want to stand out and I want to do all of these things, it is going to cost more. You know, a custom built billboard is not going to cost the same as a digital out-of-home panel in the tube. These things are not created equal. So yes, I don't necessarily think that that the cheapness in media is always the virtue that that it has to be. I just don't want to overpay. Like, and those to me are two different things.
I think even going cheap can actually damage your brand as well. You know, I mean, there is a. I think you can almost be just taking a step backward, step backward. I can remember seeing a large pharmacy's brands just showing up on it. It wasn't even a, you know, a dodgy website, but it was bordering on it was a football website. It was bordering on bloggy content, black background, white text, and I was just thinking that just people don't understand that you haven't rang them up and booked in some ads. You know, this was the early days of programmatic, and you're just taking a step backwards. And you know, for a pharmacy brand, it's trust is absolutely everything. And you know, and I think just
And perception is important. You know, it's great to reach people who you think are potential consumers in places that they want to spend time, but you also have to think about how your brand looks when it shows up there. So a luxury brand I used to work with was like, I don't want to do programmatic because I don't want my brand to appear on caravan.com. I want it to appear on Vogue. And I think that's also a perfectly valid way of thinking about your own brand. It's not just about finding consumers, it is about protecting your brand image. And, you know, in a world where unfortunately there are a lot of made for advertising sites and sites that are connected into systems, whether people know it or not, and your brand can be there, you can protect yourself to a large degree using a lot of technology. But, and I, again, you know, I'll go back to my theme. I'm a difficult client. I remember some, an ad appeared on a site that we found in the log files that I wasn't happy with. And they were like, but it was only one impression. I was like, what if that was the one impression someone took a photo of and put on social media? How would we feel about that? Right? Brand perception and the way that brands show up is everything. When your brands appear in places that you don't expect, you have to be able to protect yourself from that. And you know, you start seeing conversations more around contextual buying and direct deals coming more and more, certainly noveling around on LinkedIn anyway, that to have that very concrete brand protectedness is still something that a lot of marketers worry about and are kept up at night.
Think, I mean, for luxury brands are always the ones who, I mean, completely get this, and it's very clear in their head where they should be and what they need to do to maintain their brand. But do you feel like brands who aren't necessarily at the luxury end of the market, Are they too free and easy about context? So, I know.
Well, I think luxury gets a bit of a bad rap, right, for being very protectionist of its brand, because that's, for some people, it's their physical name. If you are, a Tom Ford, if your ad appears somewhere that you really don't like, that's your physical name that someone has put out there. But I love your example of a pharmaceutical retailer. things that want to inspire trust. Would you trust your insurance company as much if ads appeared in places that you were like, that feels very off-brand? I mean, I know no consumer sits there going, that feels off-brand, but it might just give them the ick,
Yeah.
or like be confusing as to why it's there. And I think there's some interesting studies that I've been looking at around the correlation between how many data points you use to send things out into the world reaches a tipping point when it becomes too precise for consumers, because all of a sudden they see the Wizard of Oz behind the curtain, right? They like, how do they know that? It stops feeling friendly and convenient, and it starts feeling weird. And that's not only just going to make you net neutral about that brand, you're probably going to think, I don't like it very much and I won't buy it again, or I won't buy it in the first place. So it is finding that balance between, wanting people to know that you're there and wanting to seem like you understand your consumer and creeping them out. And I think one of my challenges with programmatic over the years was that, it downplayed consumer insight because it was like, oh, well, we know loads of stuff about these people. And that became the reliance. It was first party data and signals. And, we've got in the SDK and they've got loads of pictures of dogs on their phone. So probably they own a dog. We should send them dog food adverts. And that starts to take away some of the craft that we were talking about earlier. Don't get me wrong, I'm not anti-data. And just the way that it gets applied can replace that craft of thinking about really understanding consumers and then making sure that you also understand your own brand and what you want to stand for or portray about yourself, let's say, rather than stand for, because that sounds very worthy. And therefore, where do those two things naturally come together? So that you can demonstrate that you do understand them through whether that's smart creative or smart placement, but not so much in a way that it feels like you're being followed.
Yeah. Do you think programmatic has been a net positive for advertisers generally?
It's probably net neutral, really. I think it's been a wild ride in a lot of ways. I think in areas, it's had a very bad reputation for some murkiness and supply path and sustainability issues, etc. I think when it's done really, and you can separate that from programmatic as a mechanic versus the way it's been deployed, if that makes sense. So programmatic as a kind of biddable, being able to, be in smart places without having 4,000 lines on a media plan. Like, you can see value in that. I think just sometimes the way it's been deployed and the, you talk about the sort of, and we always get this in media, you get the proliferation and, you went from DSPs starting to all of a sudden there's thousands of them. And then every publisher, because now no one wants to pay for content because it's online, right? Every publisher needing to be connected to every single DSP, which can then got into reselling, and then you get multiple hops, and then you got the publishers actually ended up with no money for all these connections, or not no money, but less money for the connections than potentially they used to, and especially versus when they used to do direct deals. So actually there's been impacts all around, and then for the DSPs as well, there's been a lot of pressure on them to make change and clean supply paths and have more transparency. So I would say it's been that balance of how to be able to do digital at scale, But then there were issues around quality control, and equally, was the experience brilliant? I don't think anyone's ever sat there and gone, wow, look at this amazing mobile banner ad that I've been delivered. So I think it is about understanding how do we not necessarily lose the mechanics of programmatic, but clean up the areas where it needs cleaning up. So I would say net neutral.
Yeah, it is a shame that we don't ever really think, oh, what an amazing display creative. I felt like there was a time where I'd be impressed by maybe a page takeover, and I'd be like, well, this is actually really
Yes.
impressive. There'd be lots of work in it, and it would have real impact. And you just don't see that kind of thing anymore. It's like we've gone backwards in some
It's
ways.
true. I was showing an example and I couldn't really find it properly. But there was the one, it was a YouTube ad, and it was a banner ad on YouTube, and then it was for like Donkey Kong or something like that. And then it shook the whole page, and then the YouTube page like fell down and disintegrated. And then at the end of the ad, it rebuilt the page up again. And I was like, that's cool. Like
Yeah.
when you see things like that that are just genuinely, you've taken what could have been quite a dull, video overlay, and you've kind of spiced it up, and made, video in a small video ad into something that's quite exciting. I enjoy that kind of thing. I think anything where you can inject creativity into media. I remember once for Dolce and Gabbana, we put a video ad in, I think it was Marie Claire. So in the first two pages of the magazine, physical magazine, you unfolded it and there was a screen in there. It was very expensive and the reach was tiny, but it was that kind of exciting way of, and this was in like kind of the late noughties, early like 2012, 2013, around that sort of time, when I felt like there was a lot of that kind of uniqueness and creativity in the applications of media, that now we've got to a lot of standardization and a lot of scale, which is great, and democratization, which is great for more brands, but is it at sometimes the sacrifice of creativity?
And I think the answer is yes, very much so. If you could maybe wave a magic wand and correct one commonly held misconception in the industry, whether it's for brand marketers or anyone else, what would it be and why?
I think one thing, there is this sort of perception with a lot of media that if you can't measure it down to the nth degree, that's a problem. And that the more data you have means you'll make better decisions. Now, I do believe in data giving you better decisions, but, and again, this goes back to some of the bit we were just talking about. If you mistake reporting for insight, so just because you can measure lots of things in digital, if you don't spend the time instead of going, oh, we got, that worked, did it? A, were you measuring that it worked on the actual humans or just on sales? And B, did you stop and take the time to understand what that meant from an insight perspective versus just a metric? So I think data informs more data, and data should not only help you make better decisions, it should help you ask better questions.
There is a massive problem, with this sort of DR mindset, and I often think I'd love to organize a conference for CFOs to understand marketing a bit more. The CFO, we need to prove it to the CFO. We need to prove it to the CFO. I think like maybe the C is it not the CMO's job to explain what they're doing to the CFO and to understand that
I'd
not
love to, and
everything,
not just for them to explain to them. I'd like to ask them what they want to know about marketing, other than why does it work? But what do they already know? What are their misconceptions and or things that they do actually understand? But because they make decisions in a slightly different way to us is like, oh, well, they don't understand. I think some of them do. It's just we don't always have that shared space to talk about the why and show the outcomes and the insights that we get from doing media in the way that we do.
It's an aspiration. I'm not sure if the CFOs would show up.
That's
It's hard enough to get CMOs along to things.
true.
So, final question. We give everyone who joins a podcast 10 million to invest, and where would you invest it and why?
I would invest it in video. 60% of it would go in video, paid search, and then TikTok right now, if I had to. And this would be based on CPG.
That's interesting that you've answered in that way, because you're answering it as a media budget, and often it's just if you were to put it into stocks or whatever. I prefer your answer.
Oh, yes. Sorry.
I
I'm a
should
media
actually change the framing
person.
to this. It's way more interesting.
Sorry, when I see investment, I just think media investment. If I was going to invest it in something, I think there is a lot around comms planning and how comms planning and insight. I would invest it in understanding my consumer better, because then I will make better choices, and not only choices that serve my brand, but serve the consumer as well.
I think there's a huge need for that. I know that we've spoken another time where I often find that, yeah, people have started companies and built technology and even raised money, and they haven't actually gone out to market to speak to their prospective customers to see if this is something they need. And it's like they show up afterwards, which
It's
often,
always my biggest question is, first off, who asked you to build that?
yeah.
If they can't answer the question, then there's probably a fundamental problem with how it's going to go to market.
It's a fantastic. You would think it's a very simple question, but it kind of isn't. And people often just have get an idea into their head or think, if I solve this, but and maybe for a handful of people, you are solving a problem, or you're building off the back of John complaining to you in the pub that he can't do X, Y, and Z. But is that really a market-wide problem, and is that a scalable business? I mean, thankfully, people can pivot and. So many companies do, but I think it's often about, yeah, just not investing that time on the consumer insight thing. So I think that's a very worthwhile investment. Ali, thanks so much for taking the time. It's been an absolute pleasure. I've been looking forward to doing this one. And yeah, you lived up to the expectations.
Thank you so much. It's lovely to be here, and I always enjoy listening to all of the opinions of the people you bring on. So thank you for always bringing lots of diversity to it. It's great.
Super. And I believe I will see you in Cannes.
I will definitely see you in Cannes.
Amazing. All right. Well, I'll see you there in the sunshine.
Thank you so much.